We have three scriptures which will anchor our worship today. The first is the familiar opening verse of Psalm 122. I was glad when they said unto me, "Let us go into the house of the Lord." The other two are found in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, as the Apostle Paul is teaching the church in Corinth about giving. He tells them, "But since you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in love, see that you also excel in the grace of giving. Each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver." These are our sacred stories. Thank you for being here, and thank you for letting me be here. In about 6 weeks, I'm going to celebrate my 73rd birthday, and as an exercise for my brain, I recently wrote the numbers 4 through 72 on several pages of a legal pad and have been trying to think of one remarkable memory for each year. Some of the years are easy to remember. Age 5, I started first grade in Dallas and adored my teacher. Age 23, I first moved to Houston and attended Covenant. Age 28, I graduated from law school and moved to New York to begin working. Age 70, I graduated from seminary, was ordained, and got married. That was a very memorable 7-0. Age 6 stumped me for a while, but then I remembered. That was the year when I was given permission to explore, on my own and without adult supervision, my East Texas grandmother's rambling house during one of my family's monthly weekend trips to visit her. I was just learning how to play the piano, so I headed to the oak upright in her parlor and sat for a moment to pound out chopsticks. But when I stood up, something at the back of my jumper got snagged on the wobbly piano bench, and as I freed myself with a clumsy tug, I noticed that some threads had gotten caught in a hinge, which meant that the bench could be opened. Well, of course I opened it, and a treasure came into view, two old 19th century hymnals. Since singing was the only thing I really liked about church, I picked up one of the hymnals, randomly opened it, and was shocked to find a hymn I had never heard of entitled, "Jesus Needs Your Money." You laugh. I wish I had been able to laugh about it back then, but I was terrified. Jesus needs my money? How much? I mean, my dad was giving me an allowance of 25 cents per week, and he was very clear that at least 10 cents a month had to go into the offering plate, and I was doing that. But "Jesus needs your money" sounded something like what a bank robber would say to a teller during a stick-up, and I certainly didn't want to get crossways with Jesus. And there was this also this other hymn that said, "Jesus paid it all to him I owe," and I can't remember how I resolved that moment of juvenile microeconomic terror, but I do know that each of us here has been exposed to many of the mixed and confusing messages the Bible and faith traditions give us about money and wealth and tithing and stewardship. And I'm also sure that each of us has heard our fair share of threatening or guilt-tripping or off-putting sermons about stewardship, like the one I heard as a teenager about the cross being an extended plus sign requiring us to add a lot more to our tithes, or the one I heard in my 20s about the widow and her two mites, which was entitled, "We Must Give Till It Hurts." So what I'm going to do today is to depart from that inglorious tradition of ghastly money sermons and to reframe the whole concept of giving to the church in a way that reflects our gratitude about what covenant has become and can become, and also to refrain giving in a way that might free us from the yearly stewardship month and pledge drive to the ongoing rhythm of grace and gratitude and generosity that will support the purposeful life of us as people of faith, bound together in a covenanted congregation to do the work of God. I'm guessing that most of us grew up hearing about stewardship and tithing in our churches, no matter what faith tradition we came from. So I want us to take a brief look at the biblical context of each of those words. The context of stewardship originated in Genesis 2:15, when God placed Adam in the Garden of Eden to work the ground and take care of it, and to keep the garden in order. My favorite articulation of stewardship theology is in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, where the aged and ailing King David prays to God about the future building of the temple by his son Solomon and says these words, "But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you. We have given you only what comes from your hand, and all of it belongs to you." The word tithe and its variants are mentioned a total of 32 times in the Protestant Bible, 25 times in the Old Testament, and only 7 in the New. Under Mosaic law, Israelites were required to give not one, but 3 tithes. The first is commonly called the Levitical tithe, which refers to the Levites, the descendants of Jacob's son Levi, and one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Levites were specifically charged with serving God in places of worship by assisting the high priest and performing peripheral duties such as playing music, opening and closing the gates, standing guard, and packing up, transporting, and reconstructing the tabernacle whenever the Israelites traveled to a new camp. Levites were prohibited by religious law from inheriting land and consequently from growing their own crops and raising their own animals for food. So the Levitical tithe, required of all other Israelites every year, was for the purpose of meeting the basic needs of those who cared for the places of religious assembly. The second tithe mandated by Mosaic law was the festival tithe that required Israelites to set aside another tenth of their animals and produce every year to be consumed at religious festivals in Jerusalem. And finally, every third year, a benevolence tithe was collected locally and distributed during that year for assistance to the poor, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. In the Old Testament economy, not to tithe was viewed as robbing God and as a violation of the covenantal relationship with God. But in the New Testament, tithing is hardly mentioned at all, and Jesus talks about it only once. In Matthew 23:23, he cites tithing as an inadequate substitute for what really matters when he says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your mint and dill and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, which are justice and mercy and faithfulness. You should have practiced these 3 things along with your tithing." As the New Testament church took root and grew, it was never instructed to tithe, and tithing never became one of its practices. Meetings were held in the homes of members who ministered to each other under the tutelage of Paul and Peter and other dedicated disciples and deacons. So there was no building or temple to maintain and no clergy to support. As our readings today in 2 Corinthians make clear, each person was to give thought to how God had prospered him or her, decide in their own heart what to give, and then give cheerfully. These very different views of tithing in the Old and New Testaments have led many modern biblical scholars and theologians to conclude that although the Israelites were commanded to be giving people who assisted and cared for and loved others, a 10% tithe is no longer a requirement for New Testament Christians, and that instead of adhering to the law-based tithes of Israelite culture, we are now free to practice grace-based giving and to experience it as a privilege instead of an obligation. This is an interesting proposition, and I'll come back to it briefly in a few minutes. But first, I want to mention two things I've observed in my decades of exposure to church people of many faiths. The first is that a call to tithing as the prescribed or most acceptable way to give can be fraught with difficulty. I've seen wealthy people use it as a cap, as in, I gave 10% of my after-tax income to the church, and I am therefore done, done, and done with giving for this year. In contrast, I've seen generous and loving people without wealth agonize over the fact that tithing would cause them great hardship because of family medical expenses or educational costs for their children or loss of a job. As a result, I've come to believe that in their insistence on tithing, many churches have ensnared their members in a tight and formulaic moral calculus instead of encouraging them to discern what is right for them and to give from a place of joy and gladness. My second observation is that churches who consider funding the budget as proof of a successful stewardship campaign have lost sight of their real mission, which is to grow in the grace-filled generosity that is the heart and soul of Jesus. Jesus had more to say about money than about any other subject except the kingdom of God. And if we read his parables and conversations and social interactions and teachings carefully, what we'll find is a message that giving is not about what the temple needs, but about the giver's own affirmation that he, she, or they trust in God more than in their money. During the past 5 years, I participated in worship services at progressive churches representing 6 different denominations. And what has stirred me the most are some of the giving practices that have brought me feelings of joy. I'm going to tell you the ones that I hope might become realities for Covenant. The first two are big dreams of mine. First, that Covenant would join the Sanctuary Church movement and would eventually provide safe haven to someone facing the ravages of current immigration policy. My second is that we would have a weekly meal for the homeless. Trinity Episcopal Church at Main and Holman does this so lovingly and so well. Here at Covenant, thousands of dollars were raised and spent on our beautiful education building and kitchen, and I hope its use will not be just for us and for the groups that can afford to rent from us. Other generous practices are those that I see all the time in Unitarian churches. Many of them tithe the plate, setting aside 10% of each week's offering receipts and giving them away at the end of the month or at the end of the year to 501c3 organizations voted on by the congregation. Still others give the entire plate away every Sunday, correctly believing and trusting that the congregation loves and values the church so much that the budget will be met with no problem whatsoever. At another large church here in Houston, there is no stewardship committee. Instead, there's a generosity committee whose theme for this year is Living Thanks, Giving Thanks. But of all the practices that I've seen and appreciated in other churches, the one I most hope Covenant will adopt is the participation of children in the offering. I don't know when churches began the practice of having a children's message and then singing the children out, and I don't think it's a bad practice. But I question the theological wisdom of having it happen before the offering is taken, because it excludes children from witnessing and participating in one of the core liturgies and spiritual practices of the church. At a large Presbyterian church here in Houston, children of those congregants who are passing the offering plates help their parents do it. How cool is that? I myself remember being a very little girl sitting by my dad in church, and every Sunday when the offering was announced, he would take 10 dimes out of his suit jacket, spread them on the palm of his hand, give me a big smile, and ask me to choose which one to give. He provided what many churches don't ever bother to do, which is to couch every invitation to every offering in words of joy and encouragement. I learned tithing by seeing my dad model it and happily include me in it, and it made me feel part of the life of the church. I love the creativity of these practices I've mentioned, and I also love the theme created by Covenant Stewardship Committee this year, generous giving for purposeful living. I believe that each of us will be generous within and according to our means, and for reasons and purposes that are between us and God. My own reasons for giving have much to do with how, over almost 50 years, I have experienced Covenant to be a beacon and a lighthouse of inclusion and caring and theological diversity, and my deep gratitude for the legacy that has been handed to me by a small group of courageous people who decided almost 55 years ago to take an enormous risk for the meaning of the gospel and to birth this church. To the founding members I still see here, Martha Murphrey, Jean Cope, John and Ann Pirtle, and for the other charter members whose names I could not find on a list but who are sitting here today, thank you with all of my heart. In my 6 years of being a frequent sermon giver, I've noticed that I usually have one spectacularly ridiculous and funny nighttime dream about whatever upcoming sermon I'm working on. About a week ago, I dreamed that as we all walked into the sanctuary today, what to our wondering eyes should appear on this front wall but a gorgeous green banner made by Nancy Henry and having on it only one symbol, a giant dollar sign covered in glitter. I knew in the dream that I did not want that thing lurking over my right shoulder when I preached. So I quickly asked y'all for a show of hands vote about whether I could remove it. You unanimously voted yes, and with that I carefully took down the banner, rolled it up, and woke up smiling and trying to roll up the bedspread under my arm. Which is a perfect segue for me to roll up this sermon with just a few more thoughts. One is that tithing is a mathematical model of giving that may not be possible for everyone. Another is that stewardship is a model that proceeds from the idea that everything belongs to God and that our work is to manage it responsibly in service to God. That is possible for everyone. But generosity and grace-based giving, now there's a model that is as wide as God's mercy. Generosity is evidence of spiritual formation, because if we have learned the meaning of love, we give. Generosity is also a spiritual practice, a deepening discipline of faithfulness for people who know that our work is to do justly and to repair the world. Generosity is a prayer, a way of giving from our own abundance and asking God to use it in life-giving ways that we can only imperfectly comprehend. And generosity is a joyfully irrational act of worship that frees us, that creates connections among people, that dissolves those boundaries that keep abundance from being spread around, that makes our hearts and souls more spacious. best of all, generosity reminds us of the amazing grace that has brought us to this day and to this hour together. May our experience of the grace of God fill us with generosity. May we remember, tell, and teach that grace and our gratitude to our children. And may we always be open to new ways of being fully present in the holy exchange that is our relationship with God. Grace to you and peace.